Welcome, welcome, my friends, to the Beggars and Brawlers podcast. This is episode 72, recorded Wednesday, the 6th of December, 2023, which is our official launch day for Queen of Blood and Blasphemy. Today, I have another preview for you of that book, Chapter 4, plus what happens when you write a third-person point of view book inside a first-person point of view book. So just a quick spoiler warning, this is chapter 4 of a book that you will only understand if you've read the first 3 chapters, or listened to them in this case, and read the first 3 books. With that, I give you chapter 4 of Queen of Blood and Blasphemy.
Four. It is disorienting to see the streets of Saray again, the red awnings stretched over crowded market lanes, the porters and food carts and pack animals jostling for space between the Blackwater's leaning 2- and 3-story buildings. Disorienting to smell it, too, after so long away. The pungent waft of fish curry and the sharp tang of Bamani citrus, layered over the human and animal waste that runs black through the waterways, amplified by the ever-present damp of the sea. It is more disorienting to see it through Isong's eyes. The bond carrying with it not only the sounds and scents I remember so clearly from my time in the city, but also his rushing stream of thoughts. Everything here is new to him, and each new sighting sparks questions in his mind about me and my life in Saray. Which is a strange irony, because these same cries of hawkers and ring of hammers, that laughter echoing from Wet Leg Alley, they remind me of Gaxna and the days we spent here stealing our meals and searching for clues about my father's death. I take a breath, letting the connection fade, and open my eyes to the dim interior of the Clipper's largest bunk room. Dust motes hang in the single bar of light that shines through the porthole, the Clipper as quiet as Isong's connection is loud. Gaxna sits next to me, her eyes glazed and body stiff from blood push, but here with me nonetheless. Bloodborne can still see and hear, even if they can't move themselves, and so I've resolved to spend my time down here, next to her. I wear a glove on the hand that holds hers to block Miara from spying on me through the bond of touch. She knows we're anchored near Saray because of her connection to Gaxna, but we've kept her from overhearing any of our plans, and Miara's bloodborne sailors are long gone. I probably shouldn't risk even this touch in case Miara reads my thoughts through the glove, but I need it too much to resist. Maybe Miara is an ally anyway. Gaxna would laugh at that, or scowl. Wish you could see what I'm seeing, I murmur to her, as I keep just a thread of Isong's awareness open in my mind, walking through the Blackwater. It still looks like Saray, but quieter somehow. There are more overseers in the street, that much I've noticed, and fewer Daranese, maybe fewer merchants in general. But maybe you saw that too, when you escaped. Unless she didn't escape, and that was another part of the lies Miara told with Gaxna's mouth. I hate not knowing. Isong passes one of Saray's many public fountains, and I smile, remembering the day Gaxna and I sat there while 6 overseers passed by, searching for me. If Isong just turned his head, I could see our last hideout. Surprise comes through the bond, and I realize my thought turned into a blood push. Sorry, I send. Being with you this way is still strange. I'm just glad you're here, he sends back. Am I still heading toward the warehouse? Yes, I send through the bond, forming the thought like I might compose a sentence to write, rather than the half-formed fragments that make up my regular stream of thought. But there's a faster way if you take that lane sloping down. Head for the cliff you see in the distance. He glances up, and I get another moment of disorientation, seeing the Temple of Ujjay perched on the limestone promontory like a gleaming marble bird of prey. The river Thel spills white from its mouth, tumbling down the cliffs to the sea. I almost died on that cliffside ledge. Lived my whole life in that temple, except the last few months. Gaxna was a prisoner up there, too. And my enemy still walks those flooded halls. I can sense him right now, through the bond, though his blind blocks me from seeing anything more. It seems impossible, somehow, that the temple could look the same, with all that's changed. I glance through Anon's bond. He and Begdul are still on the way up there, passing into Old Saray. Anon, I send through the bond, when I see him snatch a banana fritter from a passing cart. What? He sends back. Gotta stay in practice if I'm gonna steal a monocle. I can't hold back a laugh, echoing in the quiet of the bunk room. Anon is as reliable in his own way as Isong. Just don't get caught, okay? Hey, he sends back in a hurt tone. This is the Scourge of Duran you're talking to. The one who stole your chronicles from Hiana's own mansion? You could at least not eat it while they can see you. Live a little. I shake my head and switch to Estrija's connection. She is up in the court district, meeting with an old friend over lunch before she goes to the guild house. I almost linger just for the food. They're talking Therican politics I'll never understand, but the food is delicious, and the enjoyment coming through Estrija's bond is intoxicating. The woman has apparently missed her pickles and sour cake. I take a breath and let it out, trying to ease the tension in my shoulders. Everything is going according to plan so far. They all left on one of the ship's rowboats early this morning and hiked over the headland to Saray, leaving me alone with Gaxna and the Tendale sailors. Those we keep tied up, even though Estrija and I have their blood, since neither of us has the concentration to handle them at the moment. I'll get them some exercise and food later. I huff a laugh. This is what I'm down to, while my friends infiltrate palaces and hunt down enemies. A bored shepherd, like the kids I see tending sheep on the grassy headlands. Only my sheep are bloodborn humans, and my pasture the narrow walls of the Clipper. At least I have Gaxna. I squeeze her hand tighter and open the bond again with Isong. To find him bashing someone's head against the wall, his blood a sudden boil of anger. Isong, what are you doing? He pulls the head back, lolling on its neck, leaving red on the wall. Isong doesn't hear me, slamming the head into the wall again. My breath catches at the brutality of it. Isong! Where is the controlled fighter I've always seen, flowing through his perfect forms? His hands slow, and waves of shock and embarrassment roll through the bond. Alethea? Yes, what are you doing? The emotions disappear, walled over by logic. Creating identities, I just got a little carried away. The body slumps from his grip, smearing blood down the alley wall. My heart thuds like my blood has turned to sludge. Is he dead? No, I don't think so. He bends down, and I tense as he grips the man's neck, then relax. Yes, there is a heartbeat there. Did he attack you? He's about my size and shape. I led him away from the warehouse so I could take his place. He takes a breath, and I feel that castle of logic settle heavier on his emotions. Sorry, I just got caught up in the moment. This place has me shaken, and after all the Dale we fought in Sarante. I nod, even though he can't see it. It happens to all of us. It took me forever to learn to stay controlled in the temple, because I always felt like I was fighting for my life. Did you get his information? Yes, mostly. I've been trying to teach Isong Watersight, but I see in the flash of his memories that he mostly got it through conversation. Just as good. The man is about Isong's height and size. I watch as he quickly switches clothes and binds the man. I shouldn't be this surprised. I've lost control in plenty of fights myself. I've just never seen it from Isong. Wasn't sure he could lose control. You'll tell Estrija where the body is? Yes, I send. This is part of the reason Estrija's killing time in court. Because, without me in the city, we needed someone to get this man's blood and blood push him out of trouble as long as Isong's impersonating him. If she can, Estrija is going to walk the worker all the way to me so I can read his thoughts and give Isong whatever information he needs to keep playing the role. Add him to the sheep I'm already tending. I sigh, leaning a shoulder against Gaxna in the dim bunk room. It would be so much easier if they all had water and blood sight, but I have to remember it took me years to get this far. Turns out my teachers were wrong about needing to be a specific gender to use different powers, but you do still have to put in the time. Isong gets the switch done and walks out of the alley, back to cool logic and confidence. I chat with him a little more, getting the basics of his plan. The worker he knocked out, Sambo, is actually part of the Ark's permanent crew and is scheduled to go back out with the evening tide. Till then, he says, I guess I'm back to just being a laborer. I get a flash of memory through the bond. A line of workers marching out of a massive, ringing factory in a twilight city surrounded by dry, red peaks. Good luck, I say, realizing he's never told me that much of his past. I've always stayed out of his thoughts out of respect for his privacy. I can't now, at least not until I get better control of this flood of information. A woman flashes up in the stream, her rust hair cut unevenly, running a meeting with Isong in a candlelit room with a circle of pale-eyed workers. For a moment, I feel the softness of her lips on his. Yasia, his first love. I close the bond and focus myself back on my actual surroundings, on the dusty beam of light and the quiet rasp of Gaxna's breath and the unsteady beat of my heart. Well, I say to her, that was strange, but I guess we all have our own pasts, right? I might see Estresia in the same way if I looked into Gaxna's thoughts. Part of me is glad I'll never have a reason to see enough in Anand's bond as it is. I glance there now and see he and Begdil are getting close, Anand hauling the monk's possessions up the path of insight, tended gardens of seagrass to either side. I have to take another deep breath to keep my emotions focused as the temple gates come into view, tall and forbidding and carved with the massive, spiraling sign of our god. How many times did I wish I could run out of those gates and never come back? How many times since have I dreamed of walking through them again? You will, Anand says, my thoughts apparently slipping through the bond. Only when you do it, you'll have the whole city behind you, and all these beggars will be down on their knees asking forgiveness. I laugh to see that his imagination includes him walking next to me, taking gold and jewels from the kneeling monks. There's not that much gold and jewelry in the temple, I'm afraid. Part of our vows. Then they won't mind me taking what's there, he thinks back. Porter, Begdil says from next to him, you'll stay with me through the initial meetings. I would keep my tools close. Meaning he wants me to hear through Anand. Begdil and Akifte are the only ones on our team who didn't give me their blood. It would have made this all a lot easier, but I'm also not surprised. It's amazing the old monk has bent his beliefs as far as he has. He was amenable to the idea of killing Narimes, however, if the man turns out to not have the monocle or any useful information. I think he can do it, too, if he uses surprise to his advantage. Hierarchus powers or not, I doubt Narimes could recover from a solid gut the fish. It'll take a few meetings to get to the Chosen, Begdil goes on. You'll keep your mouth shut and do exactly what the monks tell you to, till I send you to our chambers. The temple gates are closed, something my father would never allow, but open as they draw near, Anand's footsteps crunching on the layer of loose sand over the stone steps. An overseer stands inside the gate, face impassive. Sir Begdil, he says, the address already speaking volumes, that the man knows Begdil and knows he joined the rebel temple and still recognizes him as one of the faithful, but not with any of the honorifics age or service has earned him. Just Seer, same as a newly elevated novice. Overseer Hemlin, Begdil agrees, tone just as even. I come seeking waters with the Chosen. Seeking waters is our term for a conversation while sharing minds and watersight. I warned Begdil that Narimes is capable of partial blinds, but ultimately agreed with him that it would be the proper thing to do. I doubt Narimes will meet with him anyway. Hemlin considers for a moment, glancing at Anand. Anand, for his part, is as calm as any monk in the folds of concentration. Say what you will, he knows how to keep his head under pressure. I'll call for an elder. You will stay here until then, in my sight and unarmed. Begdil raises an eyebrow. Since when did we treat our brothers like enemies? Since they abandoned the faith, Hemlin says. No trace of anger or other emotion in his voice. I shiver through the bond. I had forgotten how cold Ujjayan monks could be. How cold we are trained to be. Thank Ujjaya they kept me from ascending the ranks. I have become so much more than I could have here. Hemlin gestures at one of the ornamental streams that cut through the sand and seagrass gardens, babbling with the same current that flows through the entire temple, connecting it, sparkling and warm here in the noon sun. I hold my breath. We expected this, and Begdil promised he was good enough to control his thoughts, unblinded, to not reveal anything. But if the overseer asks Anand to join him, Begdil steps into the water and Hemlin does too, likely sending a message to the theocrats for someone to come. I wonder again if it's realistic to think Begdil can get an audience with Narimes, if it wouldn't be better for Anand to slip away now before they throw Begdil in the pits for being a rebel. What did Narimes tell me all those months ago when Hao was the one on trial for not agreeing with his decisions? Dissent is the ultimate heresy. The thought just makes me angry now. For the 100th time, I wish I was the one standing there, even if it would be suicide. That would get Narimes to come. And I could think of no better way to relieve this pressure I feel than sinking a fist into his face. I glance at the rest of our team while Anand and Begdil wait. True to his word, Isong works with other Dael in a warehouse like the one Gaxon and I broke into so long ago, shifting wooden crates. Astrea crouches over the man Isong knocked out, lips pursed as she works blood to heal the worst of his wounds before sending him to me. And Taewo is most of the way to the Fist of Ujjayi, the only part of drowned Saray still visible above the waters, his mind peaceful, breath in rhythm with the oars. I choke when he glances toward the city, however. Floating between him and the spidering docks of the Blackwater is something so large that ship doesn't do it justice. It is at least 5 times as long as the biggest ship I've seen, and towers 100 paces out of the water. Taewo squints, catching my interest, and I count 7 levels of portholes before the top. I goggle at the empty bunk room, my senses filled with Tewo's consciousness. 7 levels? Plus however many more below the waterline? The Clipper has 2 total. An arc. It has to be. Isong talked about these, said that it was the Dale's whole mission, to build ships to withstand the floods. A mission Yelat twisted to benefit the richest and most powerful in their society. I knew they were large, but I never imagined they could build something this big. It sits high enough to look down on the Blackwater and much of the lower city. You could fit half of Saray on that thing. What is it doing here? Isong had said they were building them on supports at the very tops of their peaks, in case the waters rose that high. Why would they put one in the water? To intimidate, Taewo thinks at me, my thoughts apparently slipping through the bond. That has ever been their way. They fired cannons when they first came to our islands, thinking they could scare us into submission. It is just a ship, Alethea. Still nothing compared to the width of the ocean. I shake my head. He's right, but I don't think it's to intimidate, and I doubt it's to save anyone here if the floods do come. We got word they were installing strange instruments in the temple. Maybe it has something to do with that. Perhaps, he sends back, but their crafts can never replace the mother's wisdom. We will find the monocle first. I know it. I sigh. I wish I had your faith. It is not faith. The Dale have known of the floods longer than anyone, had the tools to search for the monocle for decades, and yet they follow my people around, taking us prisoner so that they might search where we have been guided. Let them build large ships. For all their tools, they are still blind. I love the confidence I feel coming through his bond. I remember feeling that way about Ujjayi in the months and years before Narimes came into power. Like if there was one thing I could count on in life, it was my God and the power he manifested in the waters. And I still believe that, maybe more than ever now, having experienced the deeper power of combining blood and water sight. I just think our God, whatever we call them, may have decided to turn that power against us. History says they always have, before. We would know, Heo says simply. Maybe not the Dale or those of Duran, but you and I, Alethea. We would know, and we would be saved. I want to argue with him, and I want to agree with him, and maybe most of all, I want to believe that Ujjayi or Jaya is going to do the saving for us, that it's not on me. It's just that all our holy visions say it is. I hear my name echoing through another bond, from Anon. Taewo, Mother bless your work, brother. I will check back in. He nods, but I'm already closing the bond and opening Anon's. Hey! Yes, what? Look. I look, entering his stream to see the temple gardens and the waving seagrass, a new monk standing in the water opposite Begdil, spreading narrow arms wide. Begdil, old friend, to what do I owe this visit? I suck in a breath, recognizing the narrow face. Not just any monk, Narimes.
Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that. This is the first real chapter of the very strange point of view that I use for most of this book. You saw it a little bit in chapter 2, but in this one, Alethea is not in the scene or any of the scenes. She's sitting in a dim cabin on a ship and talking to her friends as they go through all these things, but she's also seeing it and feeling it and hearing it and smelling it, emotions. So what she's getting is just as rich as any prose will give you of a character's experience, but she's observing them doing it, which is how we do it in third person point of view. When instead of saying, I crouch ankle deep in running water, we say, she crouches ankle deep in running water, and we feel like we're floating somewhere in the background watching it. I've written this whole series in first-person point of view, like we are in Alethea's head and seeing through her eyes. And now because of the magic that I did not plan to be this way, instead we're in her head seeing through someone else's eyes. So it feels like I get to write third person. I get to write other characters' point of views, which I mentioned is a good way to keep a series feeling alive and vital. In our last one, when we were talking about what to do with tired characters, you can switch characters in third person point of view and they'll be going through all kinds of new things. Isong still has this addiction we haven't dealt with and his relationship to his past and his dead lover. He's got all this stuff. So being in Isong's head is really interesting and fresh in a way that being in Alethea's isn't, because we've been here for 3.5 books now. But when you're writing first person point of view, it doesn't matter because you're stuck in their head. So I really didn't plan this to happen in the series. I certainly didn't plan it in book one or before book one when I was making up the magic. I just thought that telepathy was cool, but I wanted telepathy that had very definable limits, like that it needed a material to contact through, being blood or water, and that you couldn't see everything, only particular things, in this case, you know, thoughts for water and feelings for blood. And then as I got more specific about what that was, and then Alethea kind of being able to do both, and then I thought about what happens if she uses them at the same time, what does that look like? And then I needed a plot device to make sure that the deal she was striking with Miara in the end of Rebel of Riddle and Woe, book three, was a deal that she could trust. And so she used both of these sites, one of them being very new to her at the time, to make sure that it would work and to like back channel with her friends. And then in thinking about that more, I was like, wow, so now she can kind of be fully present with her friends when they go off and do other things in other places. And plot wise, that's another really fun thing you can do with third person point of view you can't with first, is to have multiple people in different places doing different things and to switch back and forth between them and create dramatic irony with what's happening between them. Like the classic Star Wars episode 4, oh, where could he be? And they're all in different places. And we see the similarities and the conflict. And as one resolves thing, then it helps the other resolve it. And so everything hinges on this one thing. And then something going wrong in one place will make other things go wrong. That's super fun to plot. And when you can't see any of those things and you can only hear about them indirectly because you're stuck in someone's head, you just don't get to do it, or you don't get to do it in a satisfying way. Like in, I released that bonus chapter for book two, because there was a scene that happened between two minor characters that there's no way that Alethea could see, but I found really interesting. And there are things that happened behind the scenes in book three. Like I actually would have loved to have written Miara's chapters for that, as she's blood pushing Gaxna and getting gradually isolated from Nerimace and Yaelat, and how the politics are shifting in Saray. It would have been a really cool layer to add to the top of the book, but the point of view kept me from doing it. So now, in an unplanned way, suddenly I have that freedom in this book, but it felt a little bit dangerous to actually do it, because this is not normal. And there are people who have strong feelings even about reading first-person point of view. They don't want to read a book where the character says I. They want to read a book where the narrator says he or she. That's the classic point of view for epic fantasy. And I knew that it was in some ways a bold move to even go as far as I did in committing the series to being first-person point of view. And then I was like, well, as long as I've gone this far, there's so many things I've done with this series that are like that. Like when I started writing it, I thought this is going to be a book about a relationship between two women. And so I labeled it an FF epic fantasy. So for people who know, they know that means female, female. And if you don't like it, you can avoid it. And then she gets separated from her lover at the end of book one, and she meets a guy that she really likes in book two. So now it's not really FF anymore. And then in book three, she starts to contemplate, how can I make this work all together? And instead of being in a like monogamous kind of thing, which is also the standard, now we're writing more of a polyamorous situation, which again is not what I'd planned, and it's not what I promised in the book description, and it's not everybody's cup of tea. So maybe it's just in keeping with that even though I made an implicit promise to keep telling you this story through Alethea's perspective, I end up in this book telling it through other people's perspectives, which is then filtered through her perspective. But as weird as that is, I hope that it felt pretty seamless and interesting for you on the page. I didn't plan this either, and I didn't know how it would be, but I found in writing it that it gave me this wonderful power to add an extra layer of emotion and conflict and thought and strategy to every scene, because not only we're not just in a scene with Isong really mad and smashing someone's head against the wall. We're there with him, but we're also with Alethea, who's not feeling mad. She's feeling worried and conflicted and wondering how she should communicate to him about this because she needs him and she needs him to not be conflicted himself in certain ways. And then they can talk strategy. And instead of us just having the character running through, what do I do now? Now they can have it in dialogue, which is more interesting because they have conflicting ideas about it. And Alethea and Isong, you may be able to tell from this chapter, are going to have a lot of conflict about how to get through this thing because he has internal motives and internal emotions that are coming up that she did not know about and he maybe didn't expect to happen. And so this weird point of view gives us the chance to be there for both of it. Instead of only in the aftermath when maybe he tells her and she has feelings about it, she's there with him in every moment. And same thing for Anand being too casual and snarky about the whole thing, and Estrija being like too aloof and more in control than Alethea is, but understanding all the politics in a way that Alethea doesn't. So she like takes baby steps with her through it and feels a little overwhelmed. And there are lots of ways that I use it. But the main way that I appreciated it and I didn't expect to happen in this book is that it gives us this whole other layer to the thing, which is Alethea's perception of what's going on. And that was amazing. And if I write more books in this series, I'm absolutely doing this. I don't know if it'll be this book. Almost half of it has her stationary and just experiencing things through other people's eyes, or her kind of in a, like, she's in dialogue with someone, but it's a very stationary kind of dialogue as her teammates are going through very dynamic things. And then she gets involved later on. I don't know if I will ever do more than that because I had some readers say that the action felt like it picked up once she was physically in action. And other readers didn't seem to care. So I'll be curious what you think of it. But I don't know if I'll ever have her, like, I don't know if there'll be a book where she's like buried in a coffin somewhere and she's like only observing her friends trying to save her or something. It would be interesting as a thought experiment, but I don't know if it would actually be good on the page. And of the two, I'm choosing good on the page over experimental and novel. One of the pitfalls that I found to this is that while she's immobile like that, she can disagree with what they're doing, but she can't do much about it. And this is a problem that I had in my previous series, The Empire of Resonance, because I had voices in heads there too, coming from a very different source, but they would disagree with what the person in control was doing, but they couldn't actually, they didn't have any agency. They couldn't change what they were doing. They could only complain and try to like cajole or influence. And at a certain point, any character, whether they're a real person or a voice or a real person who can only exist as a voice in this scene, any character like that who talks too much about a problem without actually affecting it just becomes whiny and they become annoying to the reader. And I've experienced this so many times, especially in reading things that newer authors are writing, that they have a character worry too much about a problem without doing anything about it. And it's just not pleasant to read. So Alethea could easily be in that position in this book because there are so many things happening that she disagrees with or worries about. And I didn't want her to come off as whiny. So I tried to avoid it. You can tell me how well I do. She does have the option of going further than just blood sight into blood push and water push, which is something that she doesn't want to do to her friends because she's again removing their agency. But she may end up doing it in the course of this book, not to give away spoilers. So I hope that I dodged that problem. I otherwise adored writing like this, and I loved the layering effect that it had and the special things that it let me do. I think the book would not be nearly as good without it. So I hope that you're happy to come along with me on another experiment that is not the fulfillment of a basic promise that I made in book one. That's something that I'm going to talk about in our next preview chapter, is fulfilling the promises that I did make in book one and how difficult and interesting that can be when you're finishing up a series, and also how it never ends up the way that you planned it, if you planned it at all. So you can look forward to that. That'll be coming out in a couple of days, or if you're listening to this in the future, it should be right there in the podcast feed waiting for you, along with our last preview chapter from the audiobook, chapter 5 of Queen of Blood and Blasphemy. So look forward to that. Hope you enjoyed listening to this one. I'll be back with one more. And as always, I hope this podcast finds you well and in the company of good books.
For more information on Levi Jacobs and his books, including the award-winning Tide Collar Chronicles, visit www.levijacobs.com. Or for a free audiobook, only available to podcast listeners, go to www.levijacobs.com/free. Thanks for listening, and read on.